Good morning, everyone. Reconvene the hearing. Just before we start hearing submitters, there's a question, Mr. Barr, that has arisen from evidence we heard yesterday from Mr. Williams regarding the lack of size limitation on building platforms in the rural living zone. And I noticed that in the operative plan, they are limited to 70 to 1,000 square metres, albeit in the subdivision rules. And I just wonder whether the omission in the proposed plan in room 22433 is purposeful or an error? And if it's an error, whether there is a submission that would enable that to be corrected, or would the council propose a variation to correct it? Are you able to indicate it immediately?
If you don't mind, I think that the proposed district plan subdivision chapter specifies the building platform size associated with subdivision, which is a continuance of the operative district plan, but if there's an issue there between the use of land and the identification of building platforms in terms of...
Yes, well, you see, in the rural zone, it quite specifically says that if you're seeking the land use consent for a building platform, then it limits the size. But in the rural living zone, it omits that. And I just wonder if that is... Well, I just wonder if that was intentional, just a simple, or an oversight.
It won't take up too much time, but I'll have a quick look at the rule. Yes, so 22433 has identification of the building platform for the purposes of the residential units, discretionary. Doesn't specify the size. The rule in the subdivision chapter is 27.5.1.1 on page 27.12 says in the following zones, every allotment created for the purposes of containing residential activity shall identify one building platform of not less than 70 metres squared in area and not greater than 1,000 metres squared in area. Rural zone, Gibson character zone, rural lifestyle zone.
Yes, well, I think that's fine with the new subdivision, but if you have an existing site which doesn't have a building platform, you may want to get one rather than go through the non-complying activity.
That's exactly what rule 22433 is for. It's a new rule relative to the operative
plan. Yes, I understand
but
that.
But the size.
But it doesn't. So you could have one which is equal to the size of the site minus the 15 metre setbacks would seem to be what it's saying. And I just wonder if that was what was intended. And you may want to think over that. And ponder on rather than answering off the top of your head. Consider the implications.
General Will, thank you.
Mr. Chair, I also just have one other question regarding some other information that we requested from staff, and just wondered how that was progressing, which was, I think, and how we asked for some information regarding the number of houses over 500 square metres, and just wondered how that was progressing and whether we might receive that information earlier in right of reply or at right of reply. I believe it was not an easy task.
I think I will endeavour to provide you with information by the signing by the commencement of hearings next Monday. I'll leave it at that. We'll just do what we can to find out.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you. That would be helpful, I think, given the nature of the hearings we've got next week, if you could give an indication on that building platform issue.
Certainly. We'll make that Monday next week as well. I can provide a preliminary.
Yes, I mean, it's a simple answer is it's an omission or it isn't. That's probably all we need at that point. And then the reply, you could tell us if it is an omission, how it can be dealt with.
That's fine. Good morning to you all.
We have the material here in front of us.
Thanks for your time. I don't envy you the breadth and depth of your task. Our submission is in relation to chapter 34 and number 1. In making this submission, WCG has the support of a database of over 300 people. It's got an active executive of 14 people who meet monthly. We're in key partnerships with the statutory bodies, the Department of Conservation, obviously QLDC, Land Information New Zealand, and the Otago Regional Council. They're all represented and part of that group. Then there's the growing volunteer group, and strong links with all the landowners in the Wakatipu Basin, an area who are involved in wilding pines, and particularly with community, and also the community groups. WCG was actually initiated by the local council, Queenstown Lakes District Council, in 2009, when they recognised the breadth of the wilding problem, and so WCG was called by council to form a group was to be formed and called WCG, which is the Wilding Conifer Group. Now short for its longer title. So the result since its inception is that we're now been investing over $1 million a year in eradicating and controlling wildings. Our mandate is under the title of Wilding Pines, that's part of our group, but that also includes the species better known as Douglas fir and larch. WCG strongly affirms the total ban of the planting of all wilding species under the term Wilding Pines, as determined in Chapter 34, where there's a wider spectrum than what I've actually named. And so we believe councils to be commended on taking the stance on banning all wildings. But while totally supportive of banning of wilding pines, we wish to reaffirm that we're actually not anti-tree as such. Our bumper sticker is very clear. We don't take trees, we love the landscape. We believe strongly that the right trees in the right place enhance our landscapes. And we're committed to the work with QRDC, inviting all wildlings and areas under the QRDC jurisdiction, which of course is a number of reserves and areas held under QRDC reserves. What's happening now? All landowners, councils, DOC and everyone else are required to and comply with the ORC resource management RPMS to remove Pinus contorta. So that's very clear. And WCG has submitted to ORC demanding that they strictly enforce their RPMS. But equally important is for ORC to extend their RPMS. In fact, there was 2 days ago putting a submission to them to include other Pinus species such as Douglas fir, which is the particular problem here in their RPMS. A QLDC inclusive bylaw to ban the planting of all wildlife species will actually set an example to ORC to review their RPMS and to include a ban on planting wildlife species in areas where there's potential to spread. And that's all around the Waratah Basin. We believe that as a guardian of the local outstanding natural landscapes, council is the only organisation with the power to determine the future of the areas of iconic landscapes, the flora and the fauna and the mountain scenery. No one else has that mandate in this particular area where tourism is now so important. So the mantle of conservation of these iconic landscapes rests, we believe, on QLDC as the lead agency. ORC has been very slow to get on board, although they now are starting to. The War on Wildlings, we believe, will be won or lost in this decade. The slow creep of wildling infestation has taken years to reach the present crisis, and even longer for the community to recognise and own the problem. However, there is a growing momentum of understanding the wildlife problem. It's now evident in the community. As founding chairman, I used to get constant phone calls in the early years about taking up these lovely trees, and I love trees, but I really get them now. There seems to be a community shift that's happening, I guess, not unlike smoking in public places. However, the task isn't accomplished. While a community group such as WCG can make inroads into control work, future facing in laws enforced by council is essential. Council is elected by the community to give a lead, we believe, to the community. Council can authorise such a group such as WCG to tackle the wildlife task, but unless it gives the lead to the community in recognising and alleviating the wildlife problem, then it fails. Future control of wildlings will rely heavily and is relying on council funding, and in fact the future is likely to be a hybrid organisation of WCG and council taking a stronger organisational and administrative load in wildling control. WCG calls on council to continue setting an example of being a good neighbour by removing all wildlings from council reserves and council land. The removal of seeding potential such as the Aratan Forest will flag the importance of this bylaw to the community and set an example for council to address the exponential seed spread of Douglas fir, which is the main one here. Just brief recommendations. A, to ban the planting of all wildling species as outlined above. There'll be a number of leaders who will require encouragement, direction and assistance from council and from WCG to remove the present wildlings. And we encourage council to take the initiative by writing to landowners, and I realise this is a bit outside the spectrum of your role, getting everyone to remove their wildlings. We call on council to use its media and influence to educate ratepayers on the power of wind, to spread seeds from coning trees. Certainly during what could be strong wind events, seeds are blown kilometres, and in fact we're finding something blowing right across the lake and close to it. While calling on a ban on wildlings, WCG, Vandenwald, is WCG urges council to promote the planting of fine non-spreading species, along with the land, positive advice and lists on suitable specimen trees to enhance this district. And yeah, that's our submission.
Thank you.
Thank you for your time.
Commissioner Coombs, did you have any questions?
Thank you, Mr. Wilson. I have a question. Are you familiar with the list of banned trees in Chapter 34?
Yes, I have. Yes, I have.
So is that, in your view, is that list complete, or is there anything that should be in there that's not?
No, I think all the pine species are that. To that, we feel as though we have a mandate and are aware that there's a community and media response about Rowan's and Silver Birch and the other. And in fact, when we are taking trees, I've taken some out, Silver Birch well up the Benlundy track. But at the moment, I think we have the mandate by council and the community to speak into this area of the particular Rowan's spike species. The wider view in Chapter 34 of the pinus species, Mugo, Scots, and all the others here, we prefer to complete those. Yeah.
Okay, thank you. You mentioned the makeup of your group at the start of the submission. What are the main activities? How do you go about taking out wildlife pines or wildlife in general?
Yeah, no, it's very interesting. I mean, there's a whole new technology happened within the few years, 7 years I've been involved. The main ones, if you come to big, large areas, are spraying with helicopter, what we call boom spraying, that's the width of the helicopter blade, and you use various chemical concoctions, depending on the species. Douglas fir, which is the main one here, we use a spray cook. That's the common spray you can buy off the shelf and find the spray their blooming gauze. Next solid is the main. So that's one. And then we also do what we call the new technology, which is mound spray, where the helicopter dribbles a little bit of spray, or chemical I should say, which is 80% cooking oil, 19% grows on, 1% it's a chemical that actually helps it in fact. So you see, you graze it, but you actually, the lance just dribbles it down the bark. So it's very specific. High up in the mud, we're almost under snow line, we're going to have to put helicopters as high as that. It's cheaper to take them out of helicopter than maybe one, two men. I'm on safety now. Up on those rocks, and it may take 2 hours to take one tree out to climb down. So that's the second one. The third one, the ground crews with either chainsaws or with lockers. We volunteers to do some of that sort of work, but it's big country that we're moving from Skippers to Glenorchy to Kingston, down to Roaring Meg, which is ancient, is it?
Yeah,
I can talk a lot about it. One day we may have drugs specifically be able to target the drones. That's the new technology. There's a lot of money going into R&D in this area.
Yes.
Quite exciting.
Thank you. Thanks for that. At your paragraph 4, certainly in the war on wildlife, we look one of us in the decade. Is there some sort of threshold or tipping point around the next decade that we've got a sort of a time factor that we need to beat?
The strategy of WCG was to invest, and we say invest, not spend, but invest $1 million a year for 5 years. To bring it back under control, and it'll then go on to a maintenance budget. And that's, we've been talking to council about that, and so far they didn't totally agree.
Okay. Thank you. And just finally, in terms of any of the techniques for wildlife control that you use, is there any kind of commercial gain from any of it? Is there any, is there a market for firewood?
Yep.
The wildlands or anything like that?
Yeah, sorry, I just talked about ground crews. At the moment, there is some commercial gain, as long as you can get at the trees at a reasonably low cost. Over the years, we've said to firewood merchants, there's a bunch of trees here, and they'll be great, and they'll say, if you take them out, bring the logs, cut them up, bring the logs down to the road, we'll take them. Thank you. We did a trial mock up at Lake Johnstone, where we took out 2 acres and we lost $35,000 by taking them out by hand. Taking them out and chipping the logs out. The price has gone up and down so drastically, and it's very expensive in this thing. There are some good trees up on the Bean Island, but if you take them out, how do you get them down? You helicopter them down at $3,000 an hour. That's the crunch.
Thank you.
Thank you for your presentation. I was just wondering, in terms of your work with farmers going forward, have you had a reasonable response from them in terms of finding alternatives for some of the more useful trees that they might have that are currently wild and species? Is it a positive response that you've had with some farmers?
Well, there's a positive response in A, that we're able to subsidise and help them take them out, particularly where it's got out of control.
Yeah.
In terms of replanting, that we're in that community and landowner change phase now. The Remarkable Station, for instance, they've taken out a big block of wildings where the seed was growing up onto the face of the Remarkables, and have now replanting and using a blue gum species. So, yeah, I think I have to say some are so focused on trying to control the problem with us that we're still thinking that through.
Mm-hmm.
But we're working with the Reforestation Trust and offering to supply trees that farmers can put them in. Good non-seeding trees. A lot of natives. But that's what I want to say. Although the submission is about removing them, and you'd do a great job if we banned planting anymore, it is the other side of it is that we love trees too. And I guess the other and forest debate is going to come under that one.
Sure.
Yeah.
And you do mention in your original submission that you are open to working in the Hawea Wanaka area. Do you agree that it's the same issue over there in terms of the wild and species? Is it the same risk, or as much risk over in that area as it is in the rest of
it? I have to confess that we haven't done any work. Our boundary has been seen as the Crown Range, this side of the Crown Range. It is quite clear that different species in different places are more volatile when it comes to seeding. For instance, the new group that's being called for wilding control in Alexandra, their main species is spreading radiata. And in tests, there's been some research done in this area. Radiata here, only releases its seed from the cone, probably on a very short number, maybe 2 or 3 very hot days in February, and the seed's heavy so it doesn't get wind blown. Look at a mature Douglas fir, and you've got the gondola, and you see these thousands of cones hanging on the ends of branches. Unlike the radiata, and it just takes a wind event, and they're travelling up to 6-7 kilometres in a big wind event. It's the swirling effect. So, that sounds a long answer. I'm not sure. I think that the Sequoia Targa Wilding Group are taking that Wanaka Hawea into their area.
Okay, your paragraphs on your original submission does say that the WCG is committed to work within the QLEC jurisdiction.
Yes.
So you'll be open to moving
that? Absolutely, we'll have to be, yes.
Okay. So, one question in terms of the the changes to the bulk species list and moving Pine Spadiata out of that prohibited list. You're comfortable that the technology or the tool used for identifying areas where Pine Spadiata is misfolding is sound? Do you know much about the tool, or are you
comfortable? Yeah, I mean, the risk calculator is pretty clear about that, and I think that there would be a good, if radiata was included in the areas beyond the Wakatipu Basin, then the risk mitigator would need to be a tool that's clearly used in any application for a consent to plant a radiata forest. I guess what we've experienced here is very little spread from radiata, which is surprising. Whereas you go down to Alexandra and they say that's the main one. It spreads like mad down there. A different temperature, the seed seems to release for a much longer period and spread much further. Thank goodness it doesn't hear as well. Thank you for your time.
Thank
you.
Now, Mr. McCoy. And the functions of the NZTA, and we're all reasonably familiar with those three things.
Thank you.
Yes.
This entity is an offence under the RMA. It follows therefore that there's a duty to avoid, remedy, or mitigate the worst entity effects in order to achieve the RMA's purposes of sustainable management. Transport agency suggests there's a shared responsibility for managing reverse activity effects. Transport agency, councils, and landowners and developers must all assume responsibilities. Responsibility lies with councils to include appropriate land use controls and district plans. Transport agency has developed a stepped approach to protect sensitive activities. This is based around upper and effects areas. Noise sensitive activities should be located outside environmental buffer areas. Beyond the buffer area, buildings containing noise sensitive activities should be designed and constructed to achieve a reasonable indoor acoustic immunity. Transport agency submitted and supported some rules that provided appropriate setbacks, but suggested some of the rules be amended to protect the immunity of those new dwellings located outside the environmental buffer area but still within the road noise effects area. I suggest the proposed rules of the district plan undergo a pathway to mitigating reverse sensitivity effects from roadiness. The Section 42A report recommends the transport agency use its affected party status through the resource consent process to implement the requested standards. I do not agree with this approach and suggest that this is likely to result in situations where reverse sensitivity effects are not mitigated. It would also send an incorrect signal to landowners and developers that building outside the buffer area is outside the noise effects area. I suggest the responsibility lies with council to include appropriate land use controls and district plans to manage noise sensitive activities and with landowners, developers to implement them. principal agency submitted in opposition to rule 23.6.2, which did not require applicants to propose a winery and farm buildings to obtain written approval of any person. Council proposed to remove control over the parking access in respect of the impact on the safety and efficiency of State Highway 6. Transport agency submitted that it is the transport agency's responsibility as the road controlling authority of State Highways to determine the appropriateness of an access for a proposed activity and its effects on the safety and efficiency of the State Highway. Plenary report endorses the transport agency's recommendation. Accordingly, I support this recommendation and report.
The last part of your summary here, number 7, the that rule that you're referring to is the 2362, that controlled activity for winery and farm buildings. Is that only where State Highway 6 goes through the Gibson Valley that you're concerned about, or is it anywhere that a winery or farm building might set up relative to the State Highway?
Correct. This one's pointed out, but because council were reserving control over access and parking, and as a road control authority, we suggested that it was
the
appropriate agency to make a determination on that.
So does that apply when you've got limited access road only, or to in other parts where you don't have limited access?
I would suggest the full State Highway network. The limited access road is another power under the Government Road and Powers Act. State Highway 6 through the Gibson Valley is the limited access road.
All the way through?
Pretty much somewhere about Jindawani, right through.
Sorry, can you explain to me where that is? Jindawani?
So it's on the eastern side of the Nevis Flood.
As a controlled activity, clearly,
yes, the next question.
The council would have to grant consent.
Yes.
NZTA see its role as inhibiting that requirement of the council?
No, definitely not. So obviously, consent that we granted, but reserving the right over the access, then we would make a determination for the proposed activity where the best location for the access would be. So there may be an existing access for existing activity, but that may not be appropriate to be intensified, so we may require it to be moved.
You'd be seeing NZTA as fulfilling the role that the council engineers would fulfil on other roads, where they would advise the planners as to the appropriate access, design, and location, but purely in that sense.
Yes.
What happens though where NZTA engineers come to the view that, well, actually there isn't a right place for it? What would happen in that scenario?
So we would have to provide an access, and that happens also under the Government Road and Powers Act. So we're required to provide an access to a site if there's no reasonable practical alternative.
The situation that I described would not arise because you're required to provide it.
Yes.
Anyway,
So we may require that the existing form of engineer to a appropriate standards
right.
to mitigate any compromises on that site or deficiencies.
And there might be things like having what lanes where you stick it on the side of the thing so that people, when you slow down before you turn in, whatever they're called, deceleration lanes or something, sorry, I can't remember.
Yeah. Right. Well, it would have to be reasonable in the expectations as well.
Just on a practical point, if under the provisions of the Act, if someone is unhappy with the conditions imposed on a controlled activity, they can lodge an objection to the council. Where would that leave NZTA? Because I'm not sure that there's a provision in the Act under Section 357 for third parties to be involved.
Correct. Well, we've got a responsibility to be reasonable, so I think we're not. We've got to provide that. Nexus is going to be allowed somewhere on the site, and then expected engineering submission will have to be reasonable as well. And we work in the councils and look at the activity status. In this case, it would be controlled activity, so plan clearly anticipates these activities. So
you don't anticipate that NZTA's engineers would be any more unreasonable than any other engineers.
Well, it hasn't been the case that I'm aware of.
I won't comment that. That's just the extent of the unreasonableness that other engineers may display. But no, that's so. Okay, thank you. And
so for a controlled activity, well, are you expecting that they get, you guys might have input, but for people would require effectively the written approval. Is that, I'm trying to work out what it is that you, yourself and when you put Mr. Barsman, what's your understanding to tell me what it is you've agreed to? That's really what I want to.
Yeah, we would consider us an effective party to the proposals.
So I'll just create more evidence. This is in regard, actually, it's in the 42A report of Mr. Bowers at 9.5, where he's talking about this rule about within 80 metres of its edges of seal, and in your evidence, you've helpfully provided the diagram here, which is figure 8, the buffer and effects areas, which sits to the edge of the seal. Could you explain to us why is it the edge of the seal when standard road 3 metres wide, carriageway with the edge of the seal set within inside that? If you've got a rule that refers to the edge of the seal and you widen the road, what have you, then that has a flow-on effect through to the rules of where something might have been permitted before because you were outside it. Now you've got a bit where you might have to shift further back to meet that permitted activity standard. Why is the reason that you haven't used the edge of the road reserve as the boundary?
Because the road reserve boundaries throughout are not standard, they're variable, and some of the, so so that each of the sealers from the, each of the really big staff at least, rather than from the reserve gallery. In terms of if we were to add additional width to those the carriageway, then we wouldn't be, there wouldn't be an expectation that people would shift their dwellings or anything like that. It would be the need for people that establish some new dwellings on vacant sites, then they would be desirable for them to be within those outside of those areas, or the mitigation measures that we also suggest with regards to acoustic treatment.
Right. I just thought I was envisioning a situation where each of the seal moves, you've already built something, if you wish to add to it, you might not be able to add an additional to your dwelling, depending on how far they each of the seals shifted to a new lane. They could mean, well, depending on how your house is laid out, that you're not going to be able to do that without requiring some,
yeah.
Whereas if it was to the edge of the road boundary, the rules are the same,
yes.
Yeah.
Yes, I guess my earlier answer is that the road reserve boundaries are quite variable. In some places, like the 15 buildings, it's enormous. I don't know the number off the top of my head, but it's really wide. Mm-hmm. What are those? Some of those vineyard stretches aren't within the roads.
You said that the effects are from the edge of the seal, which is to do with the noise, which is the NZTA's concern in regard to these distances of the
mountains.
Thank you, that's helpful.
Just on the noise issue, in this district, because of the climate, there's requirements for higher insulation standards on dwellings than elsewhere in the country. Does that make a difference to noise mitigation?
I'm not a noise expert or acoustic engineer, but I imagine it would mitigate a lot of the road noise effects. And I've also been led to believe, but I don't know if this is how factual this is, but the increased standards of the building codes. I'm led to believe that it's not overly onerous to meet the NZTA noise requirement standards.
With the NZTA standards, probably too strong a term, but I can't think of another one, that you were referring to, guidelines perhaps,
is
appropriate. They are the same applicable for all state highways throughout the country.
Correct.
Is that the same regardless of the amount of traffic on the state highway?
So the setback distances and the environment buffer distances, they were determined on the standard that I've used for the submissions on this. It's slightly changed now, we've got a new one out, but it related to two factors, and that was the AAET,
right,
and then also the speed environment. So I basically split those down into two speed environments. Those roads that had speed environment less than 70 k's and those that had higher. I've got a table here that's just to explain that.
That might be helpful if we could have a copy of that. If you could do a copy and send it, that would be helpful. Yes. I think that document's available on the internet.
Yeah, so I can scan it and
I can. Yes, that would be helpful.
The other question I have is in paragraph 13 of the original submission, you talked about complaints NZCA gets about noise from the state highway network. And I just wondered if you could tell us the relation to the state highways in this district, or even Central Otago district, how many complaints have received about noise from the state highway.
Sorry, I'm answer that. I'm not sure if we can provide that breakdown. That's just the national, national call centre and public. I'm not sure what extent, whether it's uniform throughout the country or not.
Okay, thank you. Commissioner,
thanks for your summary, Mr. McCall. Just in relation to the state of the evidence that you issued, in paragraphs 20 and 21, you're just talking about whether the 42A report written to the Transport Agency uses a notified resource consent process or it's a beta party status with non-notified applications to achieve noise levels, and you're saying that you disagree with that. Very helpfully you provided that diagram of that. Is it common practice or is it a standard thing for NZCA to put a submission in for a subdivision that adjoins a state highway and to highlight the noise effects of that?
Yes, we commonly do. For subdivisions, we would, as an affected party, we would request the consent notice on those titles that are adjoining the state highway and are subject to noise nuisance fee. Or it's a bit more not so straightforward for land use consent. We would often request that there was an existing noise sensitive activity that they need to guidelines for noise system.
Yes. So it's something that you commonly do at the moment?
Yes. We notify and non-notifies.
So just related to that, does NZTA rely on the council's notifying NZTA directly, or do you have staff that scan the newspapers or get a service where you're looking at? Those types of things?
Both. Yes, we have our own staff scanning the device things, and we councils typically notify us as well.
Thank you. Yes, please.
Thank you. I echo points on Ralph Davis Limited, and to my right is Mr. Boyd, who has filed a patent evidence. And we should have copies of that. Request on Rafting file submission to the proposed plan, submitting that all commercial boating activities be assessed as fully discretionary activities. And it sought the deletion of Rule 21.539, which relates to the restricted discretionary status from commercial non-motorised boating activities. And it thought that discretionary status contained in Rule 21.543 applied to all commercial boating activities, motorised or otherwise. I've just been out there, and I won't read them. I'm sure you're familiar with them, the relevant statutory criteria. Section 31E, of course, territorial authorities have the control of any actual and potential effects of activities in relation to the surface of water, surface of water and rivers and lakes. Section 87A3 addresses the restricted discretionary status of rules, and 104C sets out matters that are to be considered by a consent authority with respect to applications for restricted discretionary activities. So I think just the point I want to highlight really there is that the consent authority power to decline a set consent or grant a consent and impose conditions is limited to those matters over which the discretion has been restricted. Queenstown Rafting's concerns are twofold. By restricting the exercise of its discretion, the council has precluded the consideration of other relevant effects, and there is a lack of justification for different treatment between motorised and non-motorised commercial boating activities. And the legal effect of the council's restricting its discretion is to preclude the council from having regard to matters that may be relevant in Part 2 of the Act. And this interpretation was recently confirmed by the High Court in Lambton Quay Property, and that's the case that I've included in the case book there. And essentially the paragraphs and the footnotes confirm the effect of the most recent amendments to the RMA with respect to the restricted discretionary activity rule arising out of a former High Court decision in Woolley, whereby it is the matters over which discretion has been restricted that can be considered when you're both determining whether to grant the consent and impose conditions and whether you're determining to refuse the consent. The Woolley case had a bit more of a convoluted explanation of that and said when you wanted to grant, you could consider Part 2, but if you anyway, don't need to go there, it will change. The other potentially relevant matters contained in Part 2 of the Act that are not listed in the rule, which the council would be unable to consider. Oh, there are other potentially relevant matters, sorry, that are contained in Part 2 that aren't in the rule. For example, the former planning tribunal held in the Glen Tanner Park case, and again I've got that in my case book, that effects on the economic well-being of the community can be environmentally affected for the purposes of Section 5 of the RMA. Economic effects aren't listed as a matter for consideration under the restricted discretionary rule. And accordingly, Glen Tanner said, we have formed the conclusion from the evidence we have heard that those living and working in and about the National Park boundaries, such as the Mount Cook Airfield and Glen Tanner Park, with its associated airfield, are a community. So there the court was really convincing itself that a community and the effects on it were effects that could be considered for the purposes of Section 5 and effects on the environment. And at 9 and 10 of the decision, if there was an air accident involving the loss of tourist lives, we are satisfied from the evidence that such an accident would have an effect upon the communities to which we refer in an economic sense. The evidence showed that following a similar accident in Norfolk Sound area, tourist operators and in particular the Mount Cook group suffered a substantial economic loss caused by the reluctance of Japanese and other tourists to use tourist aircraft. There was thus potential effect on the environment with particular reference to economic well-being of the community. Applying the same logic, accidents in respect of commercial non-motorised boats could have potentially catastrophic effects on the community in an economic sense, that is economic loss caused by the reluctance of tourists and local demand to engage in such activities. Restricted discretionary status does not go far enough and ought not be just limited to effects on the water. And Mr. Boyce has addressed those wide concerns in the statement of evidence and provided some examples of historical incidents. And building on the concerns that not all relevant matters will be taken into consideration in the rule, Mr. Boyd acknowledges that safety is a matter over which discretion has been restricted. But safety is mentioned in two contexts in the rule. First, congestion and safety, including effects on other commercial operators and recreational users, and then parking access, safety and transportation effects. The context in which safety is interpreted in the rule is influenced in my submission by the words that appear with that term. The grouping of congestion and safety in my submission could result in safety being examined narrowly in the context of other users on the river, including the number and type of other users. Where it appears with parking, access, etc., the context is one of getting to the water body as opposed to safety effects whilst on the water body itself. The Queenstown Rafting submission for a fully discretionary regime is supported by the potential for this narrow interpretation of safety. Safety of the river resource itself and threats or dangers to that resource are arguably not within the ambit of the matters over which discretion is restricted. That the safety of the river resource itself is relevant cannot be disputed and is part of the river environment and border safety issues. I note that Queenstown Rafting holds people resource consent from the Otago Regional Council, authorising the carrying out safety and navigation improvement works on the river. The changing river and operating conditions are all matters that can be considered under a fully discretionary rule. And just turning to the back of justification for the distinction between the two types of boating, the justification for applying the different activity status between motorised and non-motorised boating activities contained in Section 32 report is inadequate in my submission, and unusually appears to lack support of nor any reference to the district harbour master. And I'll just set out here an excerpt from Mr. Barr's report. I won't read that because I'm sure you will have. The other thing I have done is I have attached to my submission some correspondence that Mr. Boyd provided me of an exchange between Mr. Black, who is the harbour master, and Mr. Barr in August of last year. That expresses Mr. Black's concerns at the proposal to ascribe a different activity status to a non-motorised craft. He is fully in support of both types of activity having the same fully discretionary activity status. And that doesn't really appear to have been reflected in the Section 32 itself or any evidence before you as part of this hearing. In my submission, using Mr. Barr's argument that the effects of non-motorised boating activities are more predictable, etc., should it therefore not be easier for an applicant to secure his consent even under a discretionary regime, that is, it will be easier for QRDC to process or approve as scope of effects are palatable or certain. With respect to defining the scope of issue, could this not also be achieved through the Council providing a practice note or guidance as they currently do in respect of other examples? And the Council's application form for resource consent for water-based activities provides helpful direction. And that form is tailored with some specific prompts to applicants of various matters that they should be addressing with respect to those types of activities. The effects of incidents on the community will be of the same magnitude, whether motorised or not, and that's demonstrated by Mr. Boyd's evidence. And I question, as a reason, the encouragement of more small-scale operators to set up operations as being a legitimate resource management reason for supporting the restrictive discretionary rule over a fully discretionary rule, tiers here, a sort of hesitatory competition for motivation in that proposition. In light of the background set out in Mr. Boyd's statement of evidence, I submit that QLDC should adopt a precautionary approach and apply the same fully discretionary standards to resource consent applications for all commercial voting activities, no matter whether they are marginal or not.
Okay, nice and clear. I don't even have any questions.
Oh, that's good.
Do you have any questions for specifically?
Just one, really. Can you clarify, this is on page 17, you talk about QLDC providing a practice note or guidance. The examples you gave there, is that more to do with information that the council's seeking?
Yes, because I think it relates back to Mr. Barr's section 32 analysis. And he's talking about this may encourage potential operators to set up small-scale tourism activities, but potentially effects from non-motorised activities are more predictable and not likely to be as variable. So it's really, if that's a concern, it's around imparting information by way of practice notes to potential applicants of the types of matters that they should be looking to address in their application.
The rest of my questions might be concerned is that QLDC shouldn't be having practice notes or whatever that sit outside the plan that are being relied on. I'm just trying to make a distinction between what you suggested and
what I've made that suggestion in light of the current practice. That's what happens at the moment. Whether something that continues, I don't know. I personally do think there is a place for some of that guidance to be able to sit outside of the plan, particularly when it concerns informational requirements. It may also cater for changing conditions. There may be different people to consult, depending on what's happening with the resource or who may be in, whether the harbour master's duties are assumed by some other organisation as opposed to the current setup.
No, that's great. Thank you.
Thank you for your submission. Just one question around your paragraphs 13 and 14. You set out that safety is mentioned in two contexts. Would one other way of dealing with the breadth of discretion be to another measure of discretion around safety of the users on the river, as opposed to being qualified by congestion and safety or parking?
I did have to think about that in anticipation of someone asking me that question. You could broaden or add to those specific measures, but the primary concern is the part five wider, community, social, economic effects. The river is a changing and dynamic environment, so the concern is that you might not always ever capture all of the things that you might or should be considering by way of effects.
Okay, but the trigger seems to be safety of the users on the river, and then the effect that might have on the economic and other sustainable management.
You could rephrase it, but then it really does make quite a wide discretion, as opposed to any one that utility of the restricted discretionary rule as opposed to fully discretionary.
Okay, thank you.
Do you have any questions, Mr. Boyd?
Yes.
I have one. What other rules or regulations govern operating rafting on
the river? There's a number, like all that is of life these days. Firstly, there's the Maritime New Zealand Rule 81, which broadly governs covers a range of matters from staff qualifications, flight qualifications, through to what must be contained in the Safe Operating Procedures manual and similar matters. And then, as well as that, there are the QLDC water navigation bylaws. And then, in addition to that, of course, there's the, where applicable, the Health and Safety Act, which has just been amended, of course. That'd be the principal ones, but then you get a whole lot of similar stuff as a result of employment conditions and so on as well. But the Rule 81 is probably the overarching one at the moment, Maritime New Zealand.
So that, do any of those cross over into the area in terms of the Resource Management Act?
No, not really. I mean, I think the gap as we see it and why we don't want to see the status change is just that the Rule 81 and the Lace Bylaws are quite narrow and they describe simply to what the narrow view of how safety should be maintained without taking into account necessarily the conditions of the resource. And in terms of the resource here, we're talking about the rivers and our district. And they don't take into account, for example, the wider aspects of the effect of what happens when things go wrong, the effect on the community in our district. And that's really why most of my evidence related to what happened to the community in terms of the tourism community and the people that work in the industry and so on when things did go wrong a few years ago, and why we want, if someone is to make an application for this or consent, why we want the ability to be able to work for the QLDC as a principal visually determining body to consider a wider range of factors, not just the very narrow aspect of safety as it relates to a particular operation, because there's a lot of resources required to safely operate a venture activity today. And I meant to say before too, the other control, of course, is that you do need a resource consent to operate, and there's a range of matters which have traditionally been traversed and considered in those matters.
And that's under the operative plan rather than the proposed one?
In the current plan, yes. And it will still be in the current one. What we're not liking, if you like, about the proposal in the current one is what we see as a watering down of the range of matters that can be taken into account.
When you talk about the commercial non-motorised type activities,
yes.
Can you give me some examples of what that would be? Potentially it might be using the same part of the river as your operations are, but equally wherever else you're trying to get an understanding of what those sort of activities are.
Apart from rafting, there's river surfing and kayaking and inflatable kayaks and river boarding and those types of activities, and those sorts of activities have different criteria for their, apart from the RMA, they have different criteria for their management in terms of principally the adventure regulations, which came into being after the industry and the community here took a little hit with the well-publicised river surfing accident which occurred now about 5 years ago.
So those types of activities wouldn't necessarily be governed by Maritime Rule 81 and the...
Not necessarily, no. Rafting is relatively unique in terms of a non-powered activity, but it falls under Maritime. Most of the other non-powered activities fall under the adventure regulations, but all are encompassed under the, in this district, under the RMA.
Right. And they're the types of activities that you'd be seeking to be, that would be covered by the the changes you've requested.
Well, to be honest, I haven't given that too much thought. I mean, I've obviously been thinking about this from the perspective of rafting, but I think given the that anything that goes wrong in any of those activities has a flow on right across the whole tourism sector in this community, so that I would certainly submit that the regime as it now is should continue for all of our draft. I think that in the section 32 report there was a reference made to the fact that the council thought, or the planners who drafted it, thought that the environmental aspects and the risks involved in non-powered craft were less than powered craft, but in fact history tells us that's actually completely the opposite. Mm-hmm. And I wonder, although it wasn't part of my original evidence, if you'd be prepared to accept an article here that I have, Mr. Chairman, from North and South magazine. It's more objective than some of the other ones that appear, and it does give a good overview of the of what went on at the time when things were slightly awry, shall we say.
Mm-hmm. Could you turn the grassing, river surfing, kayaking and river boarding, what about activities? I'm assuming that this would all apply to the lakes and this criteria here. What types of things for non-motorised? I'm trying to understand.
Yeah, I appreciate that. Just thinking about it off the top of my head, on the lake there was a kayak hire, which is non-motorised. I can't think of any other commercial non-motorised activity on the lake off the top of my head.
Do people do go sailing, a commercial sail boat that does not have...
Were they
covered by the motor in that boat anyway?
Not currently. There used to be a known cruise sail, there's likely to be in the future, but there used to be a charter yacht fleet which was available for hire on the lake, and that doesn't operate presently. But that would also fall under, because of the definition of watercraft, if it happened, it would fall under, as well as the RMA would fall under Maritime New Zealand, just to clarify that.
I think there is a small number of yachts in Wanaka.
Yeah, in Wanaka, I think that's right. I think I'm not familiar with it personally, but I understand that that could be the case in Wanaka. Yes.
And just for clarification, so I think a big yacht that's got a moat that has sails, but
yes,
it's probably got a motor as well.
Yes.
Is that actually covered under the motorised?
Well, no, it would be treated as what it is, not motorised.
So, but if it's got a motor.
Oh, I see. That's a very
interesting. If yachts have both sails and motors, we're trying to work out which.
An auxiliary motor.
Yeah, a motor, so
yes.
When it, well, you know, the, I don't know, the wind drives or something, you can still get all the punters back. So the,
I also don't know. It's not in my field of expertise, but I tend to be seeing legal advice on that while I was involved.
If it's a motor and it can be used, it's motorised, so I would say, irrespective of the potential time that it has the motor off.
Thank you, that's helpful.
In your evidence and in one of the articles that you attached to it, there's mention of a sequence of accidents on the road in the mid-90s. I'm sure the North and South articles are going to explain.
Yes, that's summarising.
But just in your own words, can you explain what was different then to more recently than in the
safety? Well, in short, I think I've heard this in my evidence that there were a large number of operators for the available market, and at the time nobody was making any money, and there was commercial pressure on people to do things that they probably would regret later.
Most of my questions have been answered. The only question I really have is, can you confirm that this email sequence attack has your name on, was sent to you. That's probably all I want to be sure. That's attached to Mr. Dong's submissions.
Oh, Mr. Black's email?
Yes.
Yes, he forwarded it to me because I don't know how it came about, but I was talking about another matter and he asked me for my views on what was proposed. I told him. He said that he felt strongly about it and will send me a copy of an email that he email corresponds he had with the planners.
Yes, Mr. Black's not slow coming forward.
No, he's not, and I just wanted to clarify that we did have a conversation with Mr. Black yesterday about producing it as
yes.
part of our submission today, and he was happy for us to do that and knew that we were going to do
right.
that.
Yeah, I can confirm that.
I've got a follow-up question. The, under the current plan, is non-mobilised voting require a result of consent? Non-mobilised, commercial non-mobilised doesn't require consent under the OGP.
It does. Under the current plan, it does, and the criteria is the same as for motorised.
Well, the rule doesn't distinguish between the two. Commercial
motorised,
yeah. Commercial
boating,
yes.
I vaguely remember that there was an appeal on the fun yaks, which was under that.
Yes,
right.
Yes. Yes. And Fable couldn't tie it up there.
Right.
Yeah.
Yes,
yes.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you very much. Mr. Boyd, you're next this morning.
I am. If I could just have a second to put my
yes,
hand
on. Thank you.
I have prepared some additional statement, and I hope I'm right, you know, I assume that because I'm going to be under 10 minutes, theoretically, that I don't have to recirculate it, so there should be sufficient copies. My full name is Ronald Vance Boyd. I'm a local member of the Aircraft Owners and Pilots Association of New Zealand. I'm a qualified commercial pilot, but for the past 15 years I've been flying for private and recreational purposes. I've been asked by the President of the Association to represent the Association at this hearing. The panel will be aware from our previous submission, which I'm familiar with, that the Association, which will be not the panel, I apologise, that the Association represents interests of private, recreational and business aviators, not the higher reward sector. I note that the majority of submissions received relating to the proposals for informal airports are from this sector. I don't know if it's relevant, Mr. Chairman, but I did a quick count as much as I could. There's basically about 42 submissions in support for wanting greater leniency was proposed, 13 against and 4 I was hard pressed to figure out whether they were for or against. We fully support the proposed policy objectives outlined in the Section 32 evaluation report. I have a copy of that. Would you like that, or do you have that available?
No, we have that.
Thank you. These can be summarised as saying that the rules can be improved to reduce the amount of resource consents required for land and rural locations without these activities becoming a nuisance to people. The original proposal provided for informal airports to be allowed subject to a 500 metre setback from roads and notional building platform boundaries, subject to a maximum of 3 flights that take off and landings per week. We note that Mr. Bale in the section 42A hearing report concedes that a 500 metre setback from roads is unnecessary, and we support this view. We consider the proposed 500 metre setback from the notional boundary of a neighbouring building platform to be unjustified and excessive to the point that such a condition would simply frustrate the state of benefit, and that's the benefit identified in the section 32 analysis, for no benefit to other people. Depending on the location of building platforms, up to 100 hectares of land will be required to comply. Land parcels of this size are rare in the Wakatipa and Wanaka basins, apart from farms, and aircraft activities ancillary to farming are already catered for. We accept the noise calculations contained in Dr. Stephen Child's 2012 report to Council and in Dr. Child's evidence of 6 April, but not the interpretation placed upon them in the section 42A report. We note that Dr. Child's politely states that the proposed setback distances are cautious and conservative. It seems to be common ground that aircraft noise at a neighbouring building platform should not exceed 50 dBA LDN, which is a 24-hour noise cutoff effect, although we note that noise levels from roads exceed this in many places, not included at our house. The chart included in Dr. Child's report and evidence shows that one flight per day, that's one takeoff and landing, if one is taken without a helicopter, then the setback distance need only be about 100 metres. At 2 flights per day, 200 metres, and that's only one direction, because if one looks at Dr. Child's chart, it's a pear shape, so the noise extends further in the direction of takeoff and landing than it does in other directions. He comments this on page 4 of his report. Although there are slight differences in Dr. Child's findings are broadly similar to those contained in the report of other noise experts. Council's report to the Commissioner hearing an application for the helicopter line contained a table by Mr. Beasley Goodwin on environmental noise analysis and advice service designed to quickly allow a setback distance to be known for a number of daily and weekly flights. For example, this chart shows that for 5 daily flight movements, a setback of 100 metres will achieve the 50 dB requirement, rising to 300 for 216 daily and 12 weekly movements. Looking at it another way, a report prepared by Mr. Malcolm Hunt and Associates in support of application for an informal airport by Mr. Bill Day, now that a house 357 metres away, 2.28 movements or 6 per day or 16 per week produced an average noise level of 28 dBA or 16 movements, which is very excessive, on a single day is still only produced 38 dB at the same property. These findings were relative to the noisy type 23 helicopter. I've taken the liberty of just potentially extracts that of those two noise calculations, the table, the really rectal table and Malcolm Hunt's table 2, by evidence those documents are available in the public arena, they were on the Council's website, and I can make the full documents available to the panel if you desire.
Yes, I think it would be helpful if full documents.
I can produce those, arrange of those to be provided to you.
Yes.
Thank
you.
Okay. We think that the outcomes of applications for informal airport consents may be of some help in determining what thresholds could be applied to state of objective. What I'm trying to say there, Mr. Chair, is that the Section 32 report, which we largely agree with, is seeking to make it to avoid unnecessary resource consent applications where the effects would be quite minor. And so as a guide to that, we have a look at what limits have been taken into account when consents have been granted to get a feel for what might be thought as being reasonable. I refer to a noise report from Mr. Day's application, which was granted. An application for a heliport, the former airport of Gibson Valley Lodge, was considered in 2006 by commissioners. Consideration was given to the 50 dBA LDN requirement, the application granted with conditions for 20 flights per week, a maximum of 8 per day. In 2008, 2013 commissioner search application by the suspended story of an informal airport. In that case, evidence was that noise and neighbouring yacht and emotional boundaries were in order 54 dB EQ, which is a 15-minute noise bucket, not a 24-hour one, and therefore more stringent. The commission has considered the effects of this to be no more than minor and grade 8 burdens per week with 4 per day and 2 public holidays. Once again, I can make those decisions in the form available and we'll do that. While it is impossible and improper to predict the outcome of reasonable consent applications, the inference we've taken from these and other unreported decisions is that as long as the 50 dBA LDE requirement can be met, it is likely that approval for reasonable consent will be given. We therefore suggest that it will be reasonable to reduce the setback distances for the cottage. What are we asking for? Most recreational private pilots simply want the right to operate in their own properties or to visit friends. Movements tend not to be frequent or constant. Campers are community people and have no wish to annoy or upset neighbours and try to select the safe flight class to achieve this objective. We consider that 2 movements per day with a setback of 100 metres would be reasonable with a limit of 10 per week. The expert noise evidence suggests that these limits should easily satisfy the 50 dBA LDE requirement, achieve a significant reduction over what is proposed in consent applications, and allow owners and pilots some freedom without annoying others. I'm aware of possible concerns about the hours of operation. Most recreational and private pilots are not licensed for night operations but are restricted to daytime operations. I could just add perhaps that if it came down to a choice, I think most recreational and private operators would prefer to have less landings and a smaller setback, because at the moment the proposal is that 2 landings per day, which is actually quite high for a recreational operator. But the setback of 500 metres, and the effect of that is would be in reality to confer no benefit to most private operators, because the land parcels they are landing at would make it difficult to achieve a 500 metre setback. So it would paper of choice, obviously, even if it was only a few landings per week, but with a lesser setback, at least that would confer some benefit, whereas the existing proposal doesn't really confer any and wouldn't reduce the amount of application for resource consents from private operators who wish to operate from their own small property without hopefully knowing others.
Am I correct in understanding you that with private operators, it is actually, as you've said in paragraph 14,
yes,
that they want to operate from their own properties or to visit friends?
Quite large, yes. Yes.
So, in your knowledge of the district, given that you don't have to worry about the noise on your own property or that on your friends, how many circumstances would it be that you'd be within 500 metres of the national boundary, which is only 20 metres off an existing dwelling?
Well, on a neighbouring dwelling, probably in most circumstances I would suggest, because most, to achieve, to be absolutely sure that you're not within 500 metres of a neighbouring building platform, because it could be quite close to the boundary of a neighbouring property.
Well, no, not a building platform, I said a dwelling.
Oh, the dwelling? Well, even the dwelling. If a dwelling was quite close to a neighbouring property, one would have to have 100 hectares to be absolutely sure you weren't going to be within 500 metres. Most of, in my experience, most, if you look around the Wakatipu Basin, the Wanaka Basin, most places where private landowners would want to land perhaps close to their house, another house would be within 500 metres.
Sorry, could you, maths not being my strong point, how do you get from 500 metres to 100 hectares?
How do you? Simply because if you assume that it's possible that a neighbouring house would be close to one's boundary, then you say, well, okay, to achieve 500 metres from my boundary, because the neighbour could have his house close to the boundary, what do I have to do? So if you take, to achieve that, you say you need effectively a piece of property, a kilometre by a kilometre, then you could be in the middle of it and be clearly 500 metres from any of your boundaries. And if you take a kilometre by a kilometre, you end up with that theory of land being 100 hectares.
question, the other thing I noted, you talk about the notional boundary of a neighbouring building platform. I've looked at the law, and I think there's supposed to be an or instead of an of. But I might be wrong. It strikes me that in terms of the noise standards, you can't have a notional boundary on a building platform. Because the noise standards are notional boundaries after dwellings.
I just have a little trouble hearing you.
It's my understanding of the noise standards on applying to airports and helicopters, and generally actually, that notional boundaries are in respect of dwellings. A building platform is merely an empty piece of land, so it couldn't have. Is that the point you're trying to make?
I'm prepared to accept that because you've got much greater knowledge of that I have, and I accept that it's a dwelling, but even if it's a dwelling, I mean, my observation of that, most of the Waikato Basin, Dalefield area, for example, Waikato Basin, Mount Barker, Hawea, that area, it's very hard. 500 metres is quite a long way. It's very hard to find in that rural area two properties, a property or a house, which is not closer than 500 metres to another one. Simply because most of your properties are sort of on the 20 hectare size range.
Or even smaller, 2 hectares. Ms. Little, any questions?
Yeah, I'm just wondering, I don't know a lot about flying helicopters and or landing planes.
Yeah.
Would most helicopters, talk about helicopters, be stored next to the house?
You're talking here about, in terms of the members of our association, we're talking about people who have flying as a recreation and perhaps a hobby, I would suggest, and they're fortunate enough to have an aircraft that they like to use to go to the meeting with the cardinal or wherever they happen to want to go. So normally they would seek to store that adjacent to the house, quite adjacent, I'm suggesting it could be within 50 or 100 metres of their own house, because they would tend to want to have ready access to that aircraft when they want to use it. And because most operators are aviation enthusiasts, I suppose you'd say, in terms of the association, they would water out the house and polish their aircraft, as it were, if they felt like it, so they wouldn't want to have it miles away, so they normally don't have it relatively close to the house.
Thank you. And is it relatively simple to wait for your machines to stop flying and on the ground?
Yes.
Is it relatively easy to move them?
Generally, yeah. I mean, personal aircraft have wheels, and helicopters have, there's two basic systems. Either they have wheels which are temporarily attached to the machine while it's being moved, or other people will land on a platform which has got wheels and has just wheeled into the hangar on that basis.
Okay, so there's potential that you could actually land a helicopter in the middle of the field because it's the furthest point from any house and wheel it to where it needs to be?
Well, it depends on the terrain. If you land in the middle of a grass paddock and it was very bumpy, humpy, and so you couldn't really move it, no, because the wheels are not designed to be moved on uneven surfaces, so you have to have a relatively smooth surface. Factual aircraft, probably a little more tolerant of being moved on rougher surfaces, but still limits to how much you can do.
Just on a question, no, you shouldn't question me bringing it up, but it was a question I'm interested in. Once you take off, what restrictions are there about how close you fly to the ground?
The general rule is the purpose of taking off and landing is at the pilot's discretion. Beyond that, over built up areas, you have to be 1,000 feet from the ground, minimally.
What's the built-up area?
Well, it's generally, I'm not aware of any hard and fast definition, but I mean, obviously Queenstown, Merrowtown, those sort of places with built up area, but a rural area where there's perhaps a house every, you know, here and another house there or whatever, would be is legally 500 feet above the ground. But having said that, most pilots, despite what some people might think, most pilots are not out to annoy other people. So generally, you would fly as high as possible and as far away as possible from other people that you may annoy. And if you were making an approach to land, you would generally take into account which direction to make that approach from. One of the major factors would be how could you make that approach to alleviate any noise effects on other properties and other people. Because if you look at the diagram of Dr. Child, it shows, as I said before, a pear-shaped noise profile, and the longer part of it away from the centre is, of course, the approach to departure. So I would be highly surprised if any responsible pilot tried to take off the land with that being to prepare towards anybody else's property before we land the approach to keep the noise in the, away from the direction of the business property.
So if there was concerns by neighbours, could they take those concerns up with the AOPA?
Sure. I mean, I think that in the community, in the Wakatipa Wanga Lakes District as a community, I would expect in the first instance that in the case of private recreational pilots, if neighbours have an issue, the first thing they would really do is talk to them, because people in communities know their neighbours, and I'm not actually aware of anyone having problems with neighbours, because you have to live with people and you need to be cognizant of that and act in a manner which is not going to upset them.
Thank you. Thank you. Maybe just a completion for the northern, you could get to the upper limit that would normally be flying in an uncontrolled space.
Sorry,
what's
that again? The upper limit?
The upper limit. So it understands the range.
It depends on where you are. Various parts of the airspace that some controlled and uncontrolled, and it's normally if you look at an aviation map in New Zealand, it'll have the height limits, but as a general rule, the upper height limits are not of great consequence for private aviators because we simply don't usually go that high.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's fine, that's
yeah. I shall arrange to provide those decisions and other full copies of the material for which I alluded to, and get that down to you. How do I get that to the field?
If it's electronic, you can email it directly to the dp.com.
Okay, well, probably if I provide the website links, because it's on council's website, if I provide the website links, is that
that would be a
satisfactory?
Yeah.
Okay.
Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Very good for 2 weeks.